Okay, so today's second part of the seminar is going to be about a slightly different subject. And you can see the title up there, Experiences and Contradictions. How did the British commemorate the Great War in 2014? So we're moving away a little bit from the question of historiography, which is the history of history, what influences and what changes were made in how the history of the First World War was written over the years, and moving on to commemoration, which has become, as I mentioned, a very popular subject for historians to study. But now we have a particularly good example, because 2014 was the biggest commemoration jamboree in the history of Britain. There has never been a commemoration which involved so many people, so many activities, which is interesting in itself. I mean, what other subjects could have provoked enormous commemorations? Perhaps the anniversary of Charles I being executed in 1642, but everybody seems to have forgotten that. Yeah, the English Republic, which lasted 11 years in the 17th century. Okay, not so big. Well, obviously, we don't have the French Revolution. The bicentenary of the French Revolution led to quite a big commemoration in France. Even that, I think, was smaller than this this 1914 one. Now, I've mentioned why the British seem to be more interested than many nations in this, and that is that the narrative of the First and Second World War from Britain's point of view can be presented as quite simple. It can be presented. There were two wars. We won both of them, and we were right in the first and the second. Now, I'm not saying that's my opinion, as you get, but it's not complicated in itself. What was obviously in France, if you start doing the two first, it was, oh, and then we were divided, and half of it was occupied in Vichy, and it can't be put into a nice fairy story in quite the same way. So let's have a look then at the commemorations which have been set up. And I've entitled it Experiences and Contradictions for a reason which will become clear, I hope. First of all, experiences, and that is linked to the move towards social and cultural history in the sense that what has often been put forward as a priority is remembering what people's experiences were. So not just celebrating the great victories of such and such a battle or such and such a battle or the end of the war, but looking in detail and remembering in considerable detail how people lived through it, yeah, the experiences. And this is very, very dominant. We'll see this in a moment. And secondly, because historians are paid to look for contradictions. Yeah, if everything is simple, well, it's not so interesting. So contradictions, and we'll look at some of the contradictions. And some of them are a little bit surprising. I mean, certainly some of my French friends, when they said, oh, well, commemoration of the First World War in Britain in 2014, that must be a very boring subject. You have a lot of parades with military people saying Britain was wonderful because we won, and that's the end. Not at all. Much more complicated than that, and I hope much more interesting than that. But before going on to 2014 in itself, we need to move back a little bit to what already happened to commemorate the First World War before 2014, what tended to happen every year. So here, for example, you have a very typical picture from the 11th of November. Every year in Britain, on the 11th of November, this is Remembrance Day. I mentioned the invention of this word, remembrance. And in every town, there is a remembrance parade. And here you can see one in Leicester from 2012. I took it from 2012 because, you know, to look at before the centenary. And you can see, first of all, you can see that some of these people appear to be ex-military. I think they're ex-military because they look rather old to be in the military, yes? The 11th of November.
Like in France.
That's right, yes. I think it's the day of the signing of the armistice. Yeah. So, and here you can see, first of all, you can see that they're very old. Now, they are not so old that they fought in the First World War. But they are very old, so it does seem to be a rather old person. And the other thing is, can you see what they are carrying? Say again? Ah, that's a good point, actually. Maybe they are pictures. I don't think so. I don't think they are. Yeah, they're flowers, and they're wreaths of flowers, so the kohon, yeah, they're wreaths. But I'm pretty sure they are particular flowers, and that is that they are poppies. Because the poppy has become the symbol massively in Britain. Did you see any poppies when you were in Britain? In there, yes, okay. So, you could see Remembrance Days, but as you can see, this is not a mass movement. This is Leicester, a few dozen people, maybe 100. Yeah, so nothing big, but you know, regular. I will come the symbol of remembering the First World War. I will be saying a lot more about poppies. You know, poppies is going to be a little bit the centre of the story here. Yes.
To compare with France, so it's a holiday as well.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Yeah, that's partly because in Britain, bank holidays are always on a Monday. Don't ask me why. It's very organized. This is why we never have in France what you have in Britain, le pont. Yeah, it doesn't exist because all bank holidays are on a Monday. So no, it's not a holiday, but it is a national celebration. There is a parade in London, which is on the television, and I will go on to a couple more events here.
And that commemoration, is it an official one with the Prime Minister, maybe the Queen, or I don't know, as in France, or is it?
Absolutely, yes, yeah. Yes, so you could see the Queen if you wanted to on the television every 11th of November. Yes, you can tell I'm not really interested. But there you go. Yes, so that kind of thing. But this is not a mass movement. Most people are not going to these. The second obvious permanent. Yes.
Sorry again, but if somebody wants to go there, but he has to work, how?
That's a good question, yes. I don't know, maybe they have them in the afternoon, or maybe they might have them in the Sunday before or the Sunday afterwards. I think there's something like that that goes on. You know, they don't get too fussed about the timing, I think. I don't think there's the interest, really. I don't think there's the interest for a mass movement before 2014, anyway. The second thing which is universally present is the war memorial. And this one is from Burnley. It's a small town near where I live, near where my mother lives. They have a particular role. First of all, most people walk past them in the morning and don't think about them. You know, monuments represent something, but they don't necessarily represent the attitude of the people, because look at them. But here is a fairly typical one of the Burnley War Memorial in Portland Stone, with carved figures of a soldier, a sailor, and an airman, and on each side you have bronze figures representing wives or mothers. There are also some interesting symbolic elements in the design, such as there was a rosemary bush apparently somewhere. I can't see it, but there you go. And a cricket ball. A cricket bat. Can you see a cricket bat?
That's the
replay. That's right. Is that not a sword? No, it may be a cricket bat. Yes, there you go. Well, it says it's a cricket bat, so it must be representing, you know, that they were young men and that they loved cricket like young men do. This was unveiled in 1926. Yeah, so that's very, very typical. The war memorials are mostly from the 1920s. And when they opened the memorial, there were 30,000 people at the ceremony in 1926. Obviously, it's much more popular at the time. Designed by quite a famous sculptor, who was also the man who designed the gates of Buckingham Palace. There you go. Now you know. So this is quite a small town, but it's got its war memorial. And of course, this is also the case in France. So or you sometimes have villages where there are more names on the war memorial than people who live in the village in France. So France lost far more than Britain in the war. Just one more example. 1922, again, typical time for memorials to be built. This one is in Brighton. This is a different choice. It's a choice of a fountain, memorial fountain. And in the two cases, however, you'll notice the absence of religious symbols, which still needs some studying, I think, the absence of... and this has one end of the pool, a colonnade of four-sided stone columns, and there are names of different battles in the stone panel. And a lot of symbolic laurels, the laurier, of course, laurels is the symbol of victory. You have an inscription in here. You have three paragraphs. The first paragraph reads, "We cheered you forth, noble and kind and brave. Under your country's triumphing flag you fell. It floats true hearts over each quiet grave, brave and noble and kind, hail and farewell." Yeah, so a very traditional hero document there. On the other side it says, "A good life has its number of days, but a good name shall continue forever." So this is the idea, yes, you will never be forgotten, and therefore that your sacrifice was worthwhile, with the word sacrifice. "This memorial is dedicated to the servicemen and women of Brighton who gave their lives in the First World War, 1914-18, the Second World War, 1939-45. Very, very interesting. Almost everywhere, the Second World War was simply added on the bottom of an already existing memorial. And so the style of the memorial is established in the First World War and the Second World War, and sometimes and other conflicts since. These two elements, the Remembrance Day Parade and the monuments, have always been present. And the other thing which has always been present is the poppy. And here you have a poppy. It's a paper. It's a poppy made of paper. Now, the poppy was the symbol of the First World War because, according to somebody, which it may be true, it was the first flowers which grew again on the battlefields, because there is very, very powerful, very strong flower. It revives, and so a symbol of what I guess hope and beauty in the middle of devastation. And in the early 1920s, under the sponsorship of General Haig, one of the leading generals of the First World War, was established the Poppy Campaign by an organisation called the Royal British Legion. The Royal British Legion, so Royal British Legion. And the Royal British Legion collects money to help ex-soldiers. Now, perhaps they sometimes help soldiers, but in general they help ex-soldiers. Certainly in the 1920s it was perceived to be very necessary, because there was quite a lot of unemployment and the attitude to disabled people was not the same. And so it was very common in the 1920s to see soldiers with one leg missing begging for money in the streets. And this was considered to be, by a certain number of people, particularly shocking, because you know, these were men who had given so much for their country, etc. And so this was the dynamic behind the Royal British Legion, which was to help ex-soldiers, but also, I think it's fair to say, to have a certain patriotic enthusiasm behind. Even today, the Royal British Legion is a big charity which raises a lot of money to help ex-soldiers, although of course the soldiers who they help today are soldiers who fought in Afghanistan or Iraq in recent years. I have a story, because one of my friends was a town councillor, or still is, I think. No, maybe she's retired, in Blackpool, and she was contacted by a woman and said, "You know what, my father's died and we don't have any money to bury him. We have no money at all." And because this man had once been in the army 50 years ago, she phoned the Royal British Legion and they gave them money for the burial. So, which obviously is extremely important to people. So just a little story. So that's the Royal British Legion. Now, this poppy campaign is tremendously successful. Millions of people wear the poppy in November in Britain. And they give. What happens is they give some money to the people who. It's sold for a. So you can give £1 or £2. It doesn't matter. You can choose, and then you wear the poppy. And what does it mean? Well, that's a big question of argument. Of course, some people say It means we don't want to forget the First World War. Some people say it means we support our army everywhere in the world. So you can see it's a deliberately ambiguous campaign. Many people wear the red poppy who do not support the British Army everywhere in the world, or at least don't believe that they do. So it's tremendously successful, and of course because it's tremendously successful, it's not surprising that it's a little ambiguous, because very often if you want a slogan to have millions and millions of people joining it, then it's good that it's not too precise, because if you have a very precise slogan, then people choose it. Whereas if it's a very, very general slogan, then, I can think of some other examples, but I won't go into that. Okay. So there you go with the poppy. Now, it's semi-official, that is to say, if you buy a poppy in the railway station, for example, you may well buy it from a soldier, because the army sends soldiers to sell it. It's not actually sold by the army, it's sold by the Royal British Legion, which is a charity, but it's actual soldiers in uniform who sell it. So So there are things to be said about that. I'll come in a moment. It's become more controversial recently. It was less popular in the 70s and 80s. You saw them, but it wasn't so universal. Today you really see a lot of them in November. However, obviously this situation of a tradition of November being big, remembering the First World War, is going to influence the commemorations of 2014. But there's something else which is going to influence them, and that is that, very unusually, in the last 20 years, there has been a lot of political opposition to British military intervention. So the British war in Afghanistan, the British war in Iraq, there was a lot of opposition. In fact, it's quite likely that there was never really a majority in Britain in favour of the war in Iraq. And in fact, the Prime Minister of the time, Tony Blair, decided not to have a vote in Parliament. Which is, obviously, if he thought he was going to win, he would have had a vote in Parliament. So very, very, and that has changed also the commemoration. For example, is the 2003 London demonstration against the war in Iraq, which was alleged to be the biggest demonstration ever in British history. It probably wasn't. Yeah, it's very easy to journalists say that very quickly. Yeah, but it was very, very big. And there, in fact, if you look at it, there are a certain number of things that you can tell about the demonstration. I don't know if you're good at reading demonstrations. Is there anything that shows you that, first of all, obviously you can see that there were a lot of people there, yeah. But is there anything else you can read about that you can understand about? Because of course you have to read photographs like you read documents, and there are a few things there. Yes, okay, so there's the actual words, yes. Let's go beyond the words and see. Okay, well, look at this. Is this our future? Okay. Is there anything you... Yes, even before that. Who made it?
What do you mean by who?
Who made the banner? Yeah, let's say it doesn't name an organisation. Now that's important. When you have demonstrations with a lot of banners which have no names of organisations, that's because they're very big demonstrations. Small demonstrations you have, there's the Communist Party and the Labour Party and the pacifists, all the organised people who demonstrate a lot. When you have homemade banners which are quite sophisticated, that means there's a lot of people who've never been on a demonstration before and they're there. There's a couple more signs like that. There are some organisations. Can you see some organisations? MAB, Muslim Association of Britain, okay, which again is something very specific to British politics recently, in that in France it's been much more difficult to get big Muslim organisations to go into the streets and make a noise, yeah? So that's one thing. Any more organisations you can see? Right, what's the Daily Mirror? Exactly, it's a newspaper. What kind of newspaper is it? A daily, yes. You should be a student. Yeah, a daily newspaper. Yeah, a daily newspaper, yeah. Well, let me tell you about, do you know about the Daily Mirror?
No.
Yeah, it's a daily newspaper that sells about 1 million every day. So it's a mass circulation newspaper. And again, this is again a sign, if you have a mass circulation newspaper, which has, in fact, what you cannot see is the front page says, no war. So in fact, you have a mass circulation newspaper which has on its front page, no war. It's not a newspaper published by a political organization. It's a commercial newspaper like François or, more. It does, but it's a popular newspaper, so they sell far more than Libération. Yes, it's generally Labour Party. Of course, it's generally the left, but it's not an intellectual newspaper at all. Most of it is sports. It's a very popular newspaper. And they have their front page, which is being used on demonstration. This is a sign of an enormous... Because newspapers have to sell newspapers. And although I'm sure that the editor of the Daily Mirror really was against the war, if it had been a small demonstration, he would not have put it on the front page, because it's commercial consideration. So that's certainly a very particular sign. Yeah. Like I say, it's not like Libération, where they would quite often have a front page which was... for a demo. So that's a very, very, very significant one. You also have, who's that? Stop the War? Yes, I think that's about it. Students for Peace and Freedom?
Freedom for Palestine.
Oh, yes, Freedom. The MAB, Freedom for Palestine, and Don't Attack Iraq. There's two things there. Yeah, so in any case, this has been one of the biggest. Demonstrations in British history. Something else to say about British history there, and that is that if you live in Paris and you say, I went to a demonstration today, there were 1 million people, then people will say, oh, well, that's, every 5 years or every 10 years we have a demonstration of 1 million people in Paris. Not in London. It's very, very rare. Demonstrations are much smaller, partly because the transport is not so good, but also because Britain is not so centralised a country politically, education is run local, is run regionally, and so on. A lot of and then of course there's Scotland and Wales, and this demonstration was more exceptional in Britain than it would have been in France. And there's another. That's the same demonstration, yeah. It's very difficult to get good photographs of big demonstrations, but you can see there's a few people there. Now, the reason that this has a link to the commemorations is that this enormous demonstration left a permanent organisation called the Stop the War Campaign, and so there was existing over the last 10 years a permanent anti-war coalition, Stop the War Coalition. And that meant that when the commemorations came, there was an organisation whose job was to say things about war and which will intervene in the debate. So this is important because when you have the commemorations, of course, the army has something to say, the government has something to say, the left-wing parties have something to say, but exceptionally this time there was a Stop the War Coalition which had something to say and was able to, let's say, make the anti-war view of the commemoration much more visible than normal. So that's an organisational question, yes, that you can have a situation where half of the population have a particular opinion, but it's invisible because there's not an organisation to make it happen. So there we go. Now, so that's the background then, what people were in the habit of doing to commemorate, and this particular and unusual situation where there was also an anti-war organisation. I wouldn't say movement, it's probably just an organisation with a few hundred people, but nevertheless quite influential. So what happened then once, the Stop the War Coalition website who are commenting on anything connected with war in the country today. That's just last week's. Right, okay. So 2014 began. Everybody knew, of course, that this was the 100 years and that there was going to be a big commemoration. People like the Royal British Legion would generally tend to say the most important thing is to remember the dead of 100 years ago. We don't want it to be political. Now, it's an interesting debate as to whether it's possible to have a non-political commemoration, but that was certainly the discourse. And meanwhile, the Stop the War Coalition and other people were saying this commemoration of the dead of 100 years ago is being used to help support what the British Army is doing today. So we want to be we want to be careful about this. And these people were saying, if you see soldiers in railway stations selling poppies, it's not only about what happened 100 years ago. It's about getting everybody to identify soldiers with popular charity and to give a positive image of the army. That's the ideological side to it. Now, certainly the multiple appeals not to politicise the centenary seem to have had little effect, because as early as the 3rd of January, the Conservative minister, remember we have a Conservative government right now, the Conservative Education Secretary, Michael Gove, wrote an article in the Daily Mail. And here it is. This is an article by Michael Gove, who is Minister for Education. Why does the left insist on belittling true British heroes? Michael Gove's a damning question as the anniversary of the First World War approaches. And that's the Daily Mail in January, so as soon as the 2014 started. And there you have the official opinion then of Michael Gove. Let me give you an extract. He wrote, "The First World War may have been a uniquely horrific war, but it was also plainly a just war. The ruthless social Darwinism of the German elites, the pitiless approach they took to occupation, their aggressively expansionist war aims, and their scorn for the international order all made resistance more than justified." So certainly there the education minister goes right in saying, no, this was a just war. The British were right to fight the First World War. So obviously the idea of it's no longer a non-political question. And so that was a very, very influential article. Some parts of the elite were divided. Remember, Germany is an important friend of Britain today. So on the one hand, I think there was a desire to say the past of Britain is glorious, and on the other hand, there's this, well, you know, Germany is an important ally today. But there's also a left critique of this, which is when Michael Gove says that Germany did not respect the international order. Of course, the international order of 1914 was the British Empire. And so it's an indirect but real defence of the British Empire, what this guy is saying. So this became political very quickly, and in response the Labour Party, so of course as you know, the British government system and the electoral system is based on the domination of two big parties. Not a whole group of parties, but two big parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. So here's the response. Dan Jarvis, Member of Parliament for Barnsley, was chosen by the Labour Party as its lead spokesperson on the commemoration. So obviously you can see here the Labour Party taking the question of the commemoration very seriously. So we don't want everybody to say whatever their opinion is. We want an official spokesperson for the party about the commemoration. Now let's make sure the message is organised. And they chose Dan Jarvis. Why do you think they chose Dan Jarvis? I know you don't know who he is. He's not very famous. But what do you imagine the Labour Party would want as a spokesperson? Yeah, of course. He's an ex-soldier. Yeah, So that's an obligatory part of, you'd be good in public relations, yeah? Yeah, ça fait partie de la com, hein? It's an ex-soldier, so nobody can say, ah, you don't respect the soldiers. Yeah? That's the, so he's safe from that accusation. Very good, yes. So Dan Jarvis, now interestingly enough, so Dan Jarvis, a Labour MP and ex-soldier, carefully chosen as Labour's lead on the First World War centenary. And what he says in this this January, sorry, no, this is August. What he says in this August speech is very interesting. First of all, he says that the Labour Party should not take a position on the question of whether the war was justified or not. Okay? So obviously they understand that Labour Party voters are divided on this question. And so they prefer not to take a position. But also it might be considered to be a little strange to talk about the First World War and say, oh, well, I don't want to say about whether it's justified or not, because it might appear to be quite an important question. So a rather special approach there. But in any case, his concentration, Dan Jarvis's opinion, was that the most important was to make sure that the centenary was sufficiently inclusive to celebrate the contributions of home front workers, men and women, and others who did not fight. So he said it is very important that we also remember the miners, factory and railway workers who kept our country going, those who worked the land and cared for the wounded. And so this is the idea that we must not commemorate just the soldiers, but also all the people who kept the country going. Now this certainly recognises a certain reality that in modern total war, the economy is extremely important. You cannot win the war without the economy. But it has two other reasons going on here. One is a vaguely post-feminist approach that if you say we need to commemorate also the people who kept the economy going at home, it means it can be commemorating men and women, because of course women's role in the battles was small. Yeah. So that's one element. On the other hand, I mean, it's kind of, I haven't seen a lot of discussion about this, but it seems to me that sometimes if you're going to commemorate everybody, it's just a question, does the commemoration lose its meaning if you're commemorating everybody at once? Because if you're honouring, it's like, you know, we've decided to give a medal, a medal to say what wonderful intellect and work and so on have. You have produced. Oh, we're going to give it to every student in Crete. And it's like, you know, there's a moment of, well, if everybody's getting the medal, it's not really a medal, is it? I mean, I'm exaggerating to make it clear. But certainly this question of let's commemorate everybody is sometimes a little bit strange, a little bit surprising. Okay, now, you probably know that the Labour, yes?
Everybody, including everyone, or is just everybody who went to fight?
No. That's exactly what he said, that not just those who went for the fight, but those who stayed at home, the miners, the factory workers, the railway workers, the people who worked the land, mostly women, and the people who cared for the wounded, mostly women. Yeah, so it's a very, very, very wide idea. Now, there's a certain sort of moral logic in the sense that at the beginning of the war, many miners joined the army at the beginning of the war. And after 6 months, they obliged the miners to leave the army because they needed them in the mines. Yeah, so it's from a moralistic point of view, it may be true that the men who were staying at home working were sometimes obliged to stay at home working. It didn't mean that they were less brave than the soldiers. So if you're worried, as many people are, about moral values, bravery and such, like that, that can be but it is a little bit strange, I think, if you get to commemorating everybody. Now I'm sure that you're aware that the Labour Party is not a radical left-wing revolutionary organization, and less and less so, and certainly it's generally considered that when Tony Blair became the leader of the party in the 1980s, he abandoned quite a lot of traditional Labour Party policies, nationalisation, etc. And in general was more in favour of private enterprise and so on. And this is one of the reasons why in this case as well, in the commemoration, more radical people would be not along with the Labour Party, but would be around the Stop the War coalition, who launched a particular campaign called No Glory in War. That is, the organisation is called the Stop the War Coalition, and for 2014, they launched a new campaign called No Glory in War. Now, this is an interesting choice. Notice that they did not decide, they did not have a campaign, do not commemorate the First World War. Yeah. Their political choice was to have a campaign, No Glory in War. So, commemorate it if you like, but don't make it glorious. That's the idea. Now, obviously, this is political thinking, because they certainly imagined, which is probably true, that if they directly attacked the commemoration, they would not get many people with them, because the commemoration is not just the past of the British Empire is glorious. It's also our grandfathers who died, and many, many more complex things. So that's one of the things that was going on there. There were some debate in other areas. For example, in Scotland, now 2014 was very important for Scotland because they were also preparing the referendum on independence. And in Scotland, some people were saying, oh, well, should we really be commemorating the First World War? The First World War is about Britain and British Empire. Let's commemorate instead the victory of the Scottish at Bannockburn. Bannockburn is an important battle of the Scottish against the English in 1314. Oh, I can't remember exactly who it was. Yes, it was Wallace, something like that. Probably, yeah. I'm not very good on all that stuff. So, but a tremendous coincidence that the centenary of the First World War, 2014, was also exactly 700 years since 1314, when the Scottish defeated the British. I think they defeated the British. Yes. The Scottish defeated the English. That's okay. Okay. Now, there were also other elements of the debate. For example, some newspapers criticised other countries for not doing enough to commemorate the First World War. Now, the First World War in Germany, in general, has been overshadowed by the memory of the Second World War. And also, I think it's fair to say that the memory of Nazism has meant that brash imperialist style patriotism is not so acceptable in Germany in mainstream parties. And so the situation has been rather different. For example, when the last Great War soldier died in Britain in 2009, they had a big, not celebration, there was a big event. And in France, when the last poilu died in 2008, there was quite a lot of noise about it. Whereas in Britain, the last veteran died in 2008, and there was no particular noise made about it. So when it came to 2014, some newspapers were accusing Angela Merkel of not spending enough time and energy and money on the commemoration. And this even was reflected in Germany, because one member of the German parliament in the left party, Die Linke, insisted, it is scandalous that the federal government is marking the commemoration of the First World War mostly through inaction. So there you have a rather interesting and perhaps surprising political contradiction, that in Germany, the people who were saying, we're not doing enough to commemorate the First World War, was the left. Whereas certainly in Britain, if you heard somebody saying, we're not doing enough to commemorate the First World War, that would be a conservative voice. Now, of course, this is linked to the fact that Germany was on the losing side. Okay, so that's the commemoration started off in 2014, and some of it was criticised for being inappropriate. Of course, Any big event is always criticised by somebody, so that's not a condemnation in itself. The BBC News website in November published an article, "Does the World War I tourist trade exploit the memory of the fallen?" So here's the question: if commercial organisations are involved in the commemoration, are they exploiting the memory of our dead heroes, etc.? Their journalist went on a visit to the battlefield in France, the battlefield of Passchendaele, and he describes it: on streets teeming with old soldiers and school groups, you can buy t-shirts proclaiming, "I'm a battlefield relic." You can buy teddy bears in tin hats. And perhaps most cynically, you can buy Passchendaele lager. On the label, it says, "When opening the bottle, please hold a minute of silence to commemorate those who fell on the battlefield." if you've forgotten the names of some of the battles, Passchendaele is... was it worse than the Somme or not? I don't know, but it was certainly a very a tremendously painful memory. Passchendaele was the battle where it was in the winter and it had been raining a lot, and a very large number of men and horses drowned in the mud. It was particularly. It's like there's something about being shot, but being drowned in mud is like, I don't know if it's worse, but you know, it's quite dramatic. So there was some criticism of commercial, certainly quite, yes, I mean, it does have a shocking side to it, I think. You know, it makes the, especially on the label about the minute of silence. In The Guardian, Simon Jenkins complained, "Britain's commemoration of the Great War has lost all sense of proportion. It has become a media theme park, an indigestible cross between Downton Abbey and a horror movie. I cannot walk down the street or turn on the television without being bombarded by Great War diaries, Great War poems, Great War scrapbooks and Great War songs. The BBC has gone war mad. We have Great War plays, Great War proms, Great War bacons, the Concours de Cuisine. Great War gardens. There is the Great War in the Commonwealth, the Great War in feminism, Great War fashion shows, and Great War souvenirs. There are reportedly 8,000 books on the war. The Royal Mail has issued classic prestige and presentation packs on the war that enable you to enjoy both the stories and the stamps." He's seated at publicité. Enjoy. So it has been presented in some places by, you know, enjoy the commemoration, and there's something going on which is not quite what you might imagine commemorations are supposed to do. I don't think. And certainly, there's a moment where you get commemoration, remembrance, memory, commemoration, remembrance, celebration. The lines can be very difficult to draw. Okay, so that's just the general situation. And now, for the rest of the time I'm going to talk about it today and the next time, I want to try and categorise the activities, many, many activities, too many to mention. I want to try to categorise this, and because the what historians do is steal ideas from other historians, I looked at Nicolas Offenstadt, who is a French Great War historian, and he emphasized that there were three kinds of discourse, memory discourses about the First World War. Three kinds of priorities. Number one, priorities of family history and genealogy. Number two, priorities of local pride and local memory about the local town. And number three, activist approaches, openly and deliberately political activist approaches. So what I'm going to do, and all of this talk is around an article which I'm going to be publishing next month on commemoration. Yes, I don't. I just don't want too much work for one thing. So I want to first of all look at some of the national events, and then look at these three categories: family pride, local pride, activist discourses. And I'm hoping that we will find that the activities they gave rise to are more complex and also more contradictory than we might have expected. It's not as straightforward as we thought. So the national, oh, so there you go, the three priorities in commemorative activities: family history and genealogy, local history and local pride, and activist views of the war. So to start with the national events, certainly the biggest national event was the Poppy Campaign. Of course, the Poppy Campaign, as I've mentioned, has been there for a while, but in 2014, the campaign was similar, but much grander than in previous years. Now, the Royal British Legion has generally claimed the Poppy Campaign not to be political, but critics certainly see it as a way of improving the image of the army and improving the image of British military interventions, for example, in Afghanistan and Iraq. Just to give you an idea, here is the 2013 poster of the Poppy Campaign. Every poppy helps us to support British armed forces past and present and their families. And can you see, you see, why did they choose this soldier? Because he doesn't have, he's lost a leg for you. This is the message, so a poppy for those who serve. So also vocabulary chosen very, very carefully. It's not an accident. It doesn't say a poppy for those who fight. That's not an accident. It's a very carefully chosen word. A poppy for those who serve. Which is, of course, is a much more sympathetic thing, yes. So you can see that he's looking directly at you, the soldier looking directly at you. You are involved in this and so on. So a fairly openly political poster, really. This is an earlier one, 2010. A few things there. First of all, very, very sophisticated money raising. To donate text POPPY to 70090. Yeah, so it's very, very easy to give money. They make a lot of money. They make a lot of money. And can you see what's happening there? You imagine?
Is it father?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, her father has died in Afghanistan or in Iraq. Yeah? Look at the slogan. Yeah. You know, what can you say? Why did they choose that slogan?
The drone poppy is not really painful, it's fine. Just do it, just support our army, it's not gonna do any harm. But compared to that little girl
Yes. So without being excessively moralistic, it does look rather like emotional manipulation. Really, you always have to think about what they're trying to do. I mean, my objective is not to condemn the Poppy Campaign, but it is quite and certainly this kind of advertising. When you're selling things, quite often you can't do this anymore because people don't like it. When you're selling, furniture or something. You look along the lines of, you owe it to your children to buy this. Yeah. And advertisers have to be careful with this because you can have a negative reaction. It cannot work. Sometimes it doesn't work. So certainly they feel free because of the general attitudes about soldiers and the First World War and the previous war. They feel free to go quite far into the methods. And of course, they have a beautiful little girl. You know, they're not going to have a drunk teenager. Yeah. But I'm sure that if you lose your father, you're more likely to be a drunk teenager than if you didn't lose your father. But it's not as good an advert. Yeah. You can see why I don't work in advertising. Yeah. Okay. So, this was the general situation, much grander. However, it went very far because, for example, on the television, people who went on television for whatever reason in November were almost obliged to put on a poppy. I have a friend who was invited to a television program, not a political program, and when he arrived, they gave him a poppy, and he said, "No, I don't want to wear one," and they sent him home. He wasn't allowed to go on television. Now, this is not the government deciding. This is a kind of informal establishment morality to such an extent that there was a big scandal about this gentleman, Jon Snow, who is a very well-known television presenter, and he didn't want to wear a poppy. And there he is, not wearing a poppy. And so Metro, which is a local London newspaper, a free newspaper in London, but they had this opinion poll: should TV presenters be made to wear poppies? Yes. So the exact opinion poll was: should TV presenters lose their jobs if they refuse to wear a poppy while broadcasting? So you can see that we have really quite a heavy, because in general in Britain you're allowed to have more or less the opinions you like, in general. But obviously a very, very heavy obligatory consensus on this. Now, Jon Snow, as you can see, he's very famous. He's quite old. He's not far from retirement. He has nothing to lose. Yeah. Certainly, a young broadcaster, 30 years old, would almost certainly sell. Whatever his personal opinions were, would almost certainly wear a poppy. But there's something else. I don't know if you can read the caption there. Jon Snow refuses. Can you read that? Anybody have good eyes? That's right, yes. When they interviewed him, he said, "Yes, I refuse to wear a poppy on television, but I do wear one in private." Yeah. Now, this may be true or not true, that's not the problem, but he felt obliged to say so, yeah? So it's very, you can see the strength of the... Now, this process of pressure was very much criticised as well, no doubt by a minority. Quite a lot of people said yes. I don't have the statistics there, but a lot of people said yes, TV presenters should lose their jobs. A lot of people. I think it was a majority. Because they are not respecting our heroes? I'm not giving you my opinion. Certainly was not seen like that. However, some people did criticise. So, for example, we have one critic from the Stop the War Coalition saying, "Poppies have become less a symbol of genuine grief and recognition of the soldiers who have fallen fighting in our country's armed forces, and more a compulsory signifier that a person is on our side." But it gets even more depressing in a moment. Okay. So the problem is to try to find who is on our side, the side of Britain, and who is not on our side. And what is the group of people who is suspected of not really being on our side? Muslims. You had one group of the British population often suspected of not adhering to the priorities of British foreign policy was particularly under pressure. The Conservative newspaper, so it has to be said that this was a minority newspaper, a Conservative newspaper, but which sells a million every day, suggested it was not enough for Muslim women to wear a paper poppy like everybody else. They should choose a more visible symbol, a hijab, headscarf decorated with poppies. Can you see the poppies on it? And one of their headlines exclaimed, "The poppy hijab that defies the extremists." British Muslims are urged to wear the headscarf as a symbol of remembrance. Okay, so you get here a particular pressure on a particular group who are being asked to prove that they are part of the national community. Now, it has to be said, nobody I know ever saw anybody wearing one. So I think it was a failed campaign. I asked my Facebook friends in England, I have a few hundred, I said, has anybody seen one of these? Nobody had seen one. So I think it was not successful, but nevertheless, millions of people read in the newspapers about it. So it had a certain importance there. And one of the strange things, it was originally the idea of a small company wanting to make money. It was not official. It was something. Okay, now this is not the only place where the pressure was very high. The other place that pressure was very high was in football. Football. It's not surprising in many ways. Football is very much linked to local pride in Britain. Yeah. I love Sheffield. I love Sheffield United. Yeah. I love Manchester. I love Manchester United. Do you want a really bad mark? That's serious. Yeah, it's okay. You know. Let's leave that. Don't go there. Don't go there. So, players from 20 different leagues, 20 different teams in the Premier League, wore shirts with a poppy on them. West Ham United, for example, wore them. So this is kind of obligatory. So, because in theory, originally the poppy was supposed to be an individual expression, as you said. But when sometimes it becomes obligatory. So there are many, many more events around football. West Ham United, for example, commemorated the centenary with a series of special events at their game in early November. Soldiers from the local barracks marched onto the grounds, a wreath was laid by local dignitaries, and a minute's silence was held before the match. Individual footballers took risks if they did not wish to conform to the imposed consensus. James McLean, a footballer from Wigan, refused to wear a poppy, and he was eventually obliged to write a letter, an open letter, a public letter, to his club chairman to explain why. So you can see that it got off. I mean, this is one of the things where from abroad it can look really silly, you know, when you're from a long way away. But inside it's a sort of hothouse atmosphere. The other place which was where dissent was evident was in Celtic in Glasgow. This is not surprising. In Glasgow, you have two football teams, Rangers and Celtic. And Celtic is the Catholics and Rangers is the Protestants. And this has been a long time struggle. So, of course, Celtic being the Catholics, very closely linked to Ireland. So the First World War, not a priority. And so when they decided to have a minute silence in Glasgow, at the football match, a section of the Celtic supporters were not prepared to have it, and the newspapers denounced them. The Scottish Daily newspaper said, "Yesterday was a good day for Celtic on the pitch, but sadly, the conduct of a section of the support overshadowed their gutsy win over Aberdeen." This is still the newspaper. "On the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, it surely shouldn't be too much to ask for grown men to stand in silence for 60 seconds in respect of those who fell. Instead, a group of Celtic fans chose to interrupt this simple act of remembrance and common decency. And the anger was clear in the messages sent to the hotline's email inbox. One of our readers said, shameful but not surprising behaviour from Celtic as a football club. They had no poppies on their jerseys, but not as shameful as the disgraceful behaviour of a small section of their support who yet again interrupted a minute's silence with pro-Republican and anti-British chants." And there you have the comment itself there in detail. And what's interesting to point out here is that from the point of view of the newspaper, a minute's silence to commemorate the First World War is common decency. A simple act of remembrance and common decency. So the people who were opposing it with pro-Republican and anti-British chants were not expressing a political opinion in the opinion of the newspaper. They were just simply being inhuman. And a little bit further up, you see, on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, it surely shouldn't be too much to ask for grown men to stand in silence. And so the Daily Record is saying that the people who chanted anti-British chants were acting like children and that they were not being decent in the normal way that normal human beings are. Yeah. So this is a sort of process of othering, as we call it. So quite a fierce political denunciation of this particular act, which was... which was exceptional. I think it's the only football match where this happened. Which brings us to all the questions of the minutes of silence, because a minute of silence, in theory, is a voluntary expression of respect or commemoration. And when it becomes obligatory, in some ways, I don't see how it can't have the same meaning, you know. It's like, you know, like if you stay silent for a minute to respect somebody, that's nice. But if you are obliged to stay silent, well, it's not really the same effect, is it? Now, I have only got as far as the national. I'm still on the national events, and I still have much more. But it's time to stop there, and I will be continuing next time.